Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation number 336, recorded Friday, March 2nd, 2018. David Hewlett. This episode of Triangulation is brought to you by LegalZoom. It's National Small Business Month. Go to LegalZoom.com/startup to download your free business startup kit today. And for special savings, enter Triangulation at checkout. And by FreshBooks, the easy-to-use cloud accounting software for small business owners. Try it free for 30 days at FreshBooks.com/triangulation. Hello and welcome to Triangulation. It's the show where we bring the luminaries, the fascinating people from our community of tech. We bring them here into the TWiT studio so that you can pick their brain. Hear about their efforts to make the world a better place. I'm Father Robert Ballester, the digital Jesuit, and I have the distinct honor of welcoming a true geek, someone who you've probably seen if you've run in the sci-fi and fantasy circles. He's an actor, a director, a producer, a voice actor, and a maker, a true honest-to-goodness maker. You've seen him on TV in everything from ER to Dark Matter to Stargate, and he's brought his talents to the recently Oscar-nominated The Shape of Water. Ladies and gentlemen, it's Mr. David Hewlett. Thank you very much, David, for joining us on Triangulation.
Oh, such a pleasure. I've been so excited about this for weeks now. Weeks, months, maybe even.
We've seen you a few times here on the TWiT TV network. You recently did an episode of Tech News Weekly talking about Hewlogram, which for us children of the 80s and before, we will remember Automan. You were basically doing an homage to Automan as a proof of concept that today's technology could make things look like the 80s. It was actually amazing. Let's just start with that because that was kind of fun. What got you into Hewlogram?
It was Aaron, really. The director who works for Red Giant, and I was looking for visual effects because I had this. I was finding this very frustrating position of being apparently in the industry, talking to industry professionals, but seeing better stuff online, like seeing stuff in people's basements that looked better than the effects that I was seeing by, you know, so-called professionals, and I was like, I was sort of tearing my hair out and said, like, guys, I wanted to look like this. And they're like, oh, that's just a tutorial from the web. I was like, yes, but it looks amazing. And one of the people who I kept coming back to, one of the companies I kept coming back to was Red Giant, because they had this, I didn't even know they were ads at first, but they were literally to do an ad for their technologies, their software plug-in technology. They do these fantastic short films. They did one in particular called Old is New, which to me is one of the most brilliant short films ever made. And it has visual effects, but more importantly, these films have a heart to them. And I, as sort of as a joke in my conniving, weaselly, geeky way, I said, you know, I tweeted, we'll act for software. And Aaron took me up on it. and he came up with this Hewlogram thing. It was like a return to my youth. I started making these films with friends when I was like 13 or 14 years old, who have now gone on. Vincenzo Natale's gone on to make Cube and these other fantastic films, and television series as well. He's working on everything now. And it was like a return to that, but with people, you know, who were sort of some people who were my age. And it was sort of an introduction to this wonderful sort of independent world in New York City. And it was just, oh, it was like the scene you're looking at right now, where we're in the car, a cop came up to move us along and then went, hey, you that guy from, you know, Stargate. And so he's like, yeah, it's fine. What are you doing? You know? So it was like, it was a really like just a magical experience. Amazing bunch of people. Aaron, I was sort of joking. We went to this building in New York, and we're in this like rickety elevator going up to these studios, and with my kid and my wife beside me, and I suddenly turned to my wife. I said, you know, I've never met this guy. He could be like, the doors could open. He could be standing there with like a bloody axe. And so my son immediately blanches. And then Aaron and I literally didn't even say hi. We just finished a conversation we'd started online you know, a couple of days ago. And yeah, he's just, he's fantastic. He's you know, he's a good soul, and he's got a love for film that is just so, just comes through in this, in his work, in all aspects of his work, you know? So yeah, it was an amazing experience.
I like that moment of you approaching the door thinking, well, we think we're doing something like a Star Trek, but it could end up being Game of Thrones. So I'm not really sure where we're
who at. Knows? Yeah. I mean, you sort of take for granted, you know, I know so many people now. I mean, you, for example, I mean, you know, I don't expect to see you with an axe, but I feel like I know you really well because we talk a fair amount. And yet we've never actually met. And that's such an amazing thing that we take for granted now, in a way that this did not exist when we started playing with computers. You know,
it didn't really exist more than 15 years ago, actually even really 10 years ago. So this is a new thing. It's interesting to me that you said you had this sort of hunger to do things better, because you saw these productions on YouTube that had better production values than some of the things that we were doing for TV for huge budgets. And I find that hilarious, because some of the people I've spoken to who are doing this, people like the Corridor Digital guys or Freddie Wong, they started doing what they're doing because they saw people like you on their favorite sci-fi shows. And they said, I wonder if I could do that. I bet I could do that. And that's how they develop their following. So it's sort of like the snake eating its own tail. It just feeds back into itself.
And we're seeing, I mean, it's funny. There was I think it was Coppola who said, the director said, not to me, just as a quote, that he was less scared of other film directors than he was of like A Kid in the Basement, that's where the next big hit is going to come from. And it was, you know, it's happening in the film world, but it's not just the film world. It's happening in a much larger scale. It's happening in the makerspace with technology. It's happening with education. It's happening. It's just the revolution is no longer you know, the realm of the big companies and the big money. There's so much stuff out there for people to be doing in all aspects of both filmmaking and the technologies around it. Another great example was we were supposed to shoot it was a Dark Matter episode, and they couldn't get the techno crane, which is this, that wasn't a techno crane, it was a computer controlled crane.
Right.
And they're like, oh, I really wanted to get it. We couldn't get it. It was too expensive. I was like, what? It's a robot controlled camera. Like what? Like give me a few days and a few nerds, and we'll have one rigged up for you. But again, there's this. I think there's a real disconnect. It happens with the medical community as well. There's a real disconnect between what's available to people and the technologies that are available. And I'm just more and more seeing this chasm between the world of the establishment and these bright minds coming up right now, you know? So I just basically want to befriend them because they're going to run things. So
it's very wise for you to see that across sectors. It's not just a movie thing. It's not just a medical thing. It's basically in all sectors. You've got a generation that has so many tools available for them, to them, from software that can do editing effects that used to cost tens or hundreds of millions of dollars just a couple of decades ago, to people who are playing with 3D printers and CNC machines who they don't think about whether or not something exists that they can buy. They're wondering, well, how am I going to make it? I've got the parts. I'll put it together. It's a very different mindset.
It really is. And it's something I'm trying to get my head around still. I mean, I'm still struggling to figure out what the best way of approaching, you know, all of these different sort of interests that I have. And it's something I see with the medical professions, particularly, where there's been this kind of, obviously, there's been this, you know, there are the doctors and they know they have the lingo. They have there's almost like almost a theater to the whole sort of medical profession. And it's hallowed halls and people shouldn't be messing around with that stuff because it's a human body. And now all of a sudden, like one of the things I came up with for the kids, my lunch club, was that you can actually get these CRISPR kits to do genetic modifications on yeast. And I was a little nervous to bring it to the class because I thought, oh my goodness, some people are going to really be freaked out by this. So we actually didn't end up doing that this year, but I'm getting them in there at some point.
It's when I was doing genetic experiments in high school, it was basically worksheets saying, okay, well, this is recessive and this is dominant, and I'll draw lines from this to this. Now, you're right. I actually watched a science fair where someone was working on a new type of yeast that would work under certain conditions. And I was thinking, wait, you're a high school student?
Yeah.
You can do this? That's amazing to me. That is science fiction. That's more science fiction than most of the science fiction that I grew up with.
And I think there's no limits. I mean, imagine going into this stuff with no idea that there are rules and that there's sort of an established way of doing this stuff. And that's what I'm seeing. And I get so excited about it because that's how we got into film back in the day when I was making films as a kid. People didn't do that because you had to have film and you had to process film and there was sync sound. Everything was so complicated. You know, the fact that Vincenzo and Andre were making these films at age 13 and 14 was a complete anomaly. And you know, when I got into film as a quote unquote profession after that, I came in with this whole skill set that people just didn't have because they weren't doing this. Like, it's not like now with this video cameras. Like, now people ask me, like, how do you become an actor? I'm like, dude, just grab a camera, make something. You got to do everything now. You know, look at YouTube. Those guys don't just write or direct or star. They have to do everything. And that's the way it is now. We've almost returned back to the day of Charlie Chaplin with that stuff. And the same thing applies, crazily enough, with medicine, with electronics, computers, programming, video games. I mean, look at that industry. That's another one that's just booming out of people's basement, you know?
I'm glad that you brought up the good old days and we're doing this comparison because I actually do want to bring us back. This whole segment has been sort of a teaser for what they're going to hear as we get closer to the end. But we do have to bring you back to the start because
I'm terrible at staying on topic.
No. I love it. I love it because people can see a little bit. I mean, there's obviously a lot of passion here, but I do want them to know about your history because it is it's pretty phenomenal. It's pretty interesting how a person like you ended up where you are today. Can we get to that in just a bit because we got to pay a couple of bills here with
of course,
with the supporter.
Do it.
All right. Well, folks, we have been talking about this new generation of discovery, about this new way of doing things in the medical engineering fields, even in the movies. New technologies, new processes always allow us to push the boundaries of what we think is possible. But no matter how hard you push and how far you go, you're always going to need to make sure that you have legal representation. It's just one of the things about life today, which is why we're so happy to have LegalZoom as a sponsor of this episode of Triangulation. Now, National Small Business Month, LegalZoom is here. Now, whether you're just starting out now or you already have a business, there's a lot that you can take advantage of. Now, just go to LegalZoom.com/startup. That's LegalZoom.com/startup during March to download your free business startup kit. You'll get tons of information. For example, you can find out how to maximize your business deductibles under the new tax laws. Plus, you'll also get great discounts. Your kit includes special deals from LegalZoom along with other offers from their service partners so that you can save a bunch of money financing, marketing, and operating your business. LegalZoom isn't a law firm, but they know what you need to tap into the right resources to run a successful business. They're not just providing legal services, they're providing life services. That's what their business startup kit is all about. So here's what we want you to do. If you are pushing the boundaries, if you are looking at a new way of doing things, if you think you've got a business model that might change the world, then go to LegalZoom.com/startup to download your free business startup kit today. That's LegalZoom.com/startup. There's no obligations, just free business resources. This offer is only available in March. So if you're listening after that, you can still enjoy special savings by using the code triangulation when you check out at LegalZoom.com. Again, that's LegalZoom.com/startup. And if you're listening to this in a month other than March, use the code triangulation. LegalZoom, where life meets legal. And we thank LegalZoom for their support of this episode of Triangulation. We are speaking with Hewlett. He is the man about town. Again, I first saw you in Stargate, and I loved it. I loved the fact that your character was goofy, was brilliant. And then it got me to think, well, who is this guy who plays this character? Who is this guy who plays the equal of a Samantha Carter? Which, by the way, if you don't know who that is, then it just means you need to watch more Stargate. Let's bring it back, because we know you as the Canadian actor, but you weren't born in Canada. You were born in Surrey. What?
Yeah, it's I joke that we've got three passports. I'm like the Bourne identity with absolutely none of his skills and only one language. It's shameful, really. Yeah, well, I was born in England. Born watching Doctor Who from behind the couch, and really raised. I mean, for those formative years were all British television. I think it's given me a certain sense of humor and a sort of British outlook on things. There are a lot of Brits in Canada, to be fair. So,
Yeah, but how did you find yourself in Canada? I mean, going from Surrey across the pond, that's not a normal thing, is it?
Well, I would have to ask my dad that. I mean, we came across on a Russian ship because it was a cheap way of doing it. My father had very little money. He just become a doctor in England and basically became disillusioned with the system there. There were people, he says he would go into the hospital. There'd be people, dying in the hallways because there just weren't beds and things. And he wanted to sort of start again in a new country, basically. And so he packed us all up on this, the Alexander Pushkin, it was called, this wow. Russian ship. And I still remember watching these crazy Russian cartoons in a little dark room in this terrible storm and, ship walking down hallways that were like this and it's indelible mark on my memory. And dad came to Canada because I think he was very disillusioned, I think, with socialized medicine in England, and then came to Canada in time to become a doctor when they had socialized medicine here as well. So he's basically a two for two on that. So
how old were you when you made the move?
I was four. Yeah.
Wow.
I was four, but we used to go, my father was really, really big on spending what money we had and sometimes borrowing it so that we could go back in the summers. Every summer we'd go back to England. So I had the best of both worlds, not in that I had winters in Canada and summers, if that's what you can call them, in England. So I never saw the sun, basically.
It sounds a little backwards, but okay.
It was amazing, though. Like, it was just, we were there for so long, we'd come back with British accents. I mean, my grandparents had this amazing place that was, they used to like rescue horses. Like if a horse breaks its leg, they would generally put it down. My grandparents would take it and they would raise it like as a pet. So there were just hundreds of animals wandering around this. It was like Dr. Doolittle. Like literally you'd be sitting there talking with grandma and this horse would sort of nose open a window and stick its head through the window. She'd give it sugar and then it would leave again. And then you would see, I'm like this, everyone thinks I'm kidding when I say this. There are literally dogs riding horses with the reins in their teeth. Like it was, they would just train these dogs to do all these crazy things. So as a kid, it was just magical. Like it was just, my uncle was building steam trains across the property using old mining, old Welsh mining steam trains and things. So, yeah, it was a truly wonderfully eccentric British upbringing every summer, and then we came back to Canada where we were, back to the normal side of stuff.
Not too long ago, the internet broke because a corgi was riding on a horse and that video just went absolutely everywhere. The fact that you got to see that basically every summer. I guess that was a magical experience.
It was. Yeah, it was a golden retriever. They always had golden retrievers and they would and collies were the other ones as well. And they were just these, I don't know how they just trained them within an inch of their lives. Like it was all very loving, but the animals would just, nobody can obsessively take on, a pet and make it such a hobby like the British. Like the British get into their hobbies in a way that nobody else can,
All right. So you have, at the tender age of four, transported yourself from the UK to Canada aboard the Russian battleship Potemkin. I know it's a Pushkin, but Potemkin sounds so much better.
Close enough.
But how do you go from that, from that four-year-old in a new country, going back and forth in summers between his new land and his old land, to developing a passion for creating content?
I was really bad at everything else. That helped. I was a huge tinkerer as a kid. Like I used to raid every garbage I could find and any old guy. If we found a television set, that was like gold. I would bring those things home and pull them apart. And eventually I got one working. But I was very good at failing to put things back together again. And for years I sort of saw that as a failure. And the reality is you learn so much about this stuff. And in doing so, I found this sort of theatricality to electronics. I found this desire to build things the way Doctor Who would build things. And I think before I actually realized you could be an actor, I wanted to be a Time Lord. That was my thing. I spent the amount of time I spent trying to build a sonic screwdriver is embarrassing, you know, because it just seemed so logical to me. Like, of course, you make the right sound, it vibrates. Of course, it's going to vibrate things out of there, out of place, and unlock things and take out baddies and things. So my in to acting was through science fiction, specifically, you know, Doctor Who. And my mom was pretty good at this stuff. So there's like Quatermass was in there as well, and the Tomorrow People, you know, they were quite. The thing about the UK is that sci-fi isn't marginalized in any way. With England and Europe, it's seen as just as legitimate a genre as, you know, drama or comedy or any of the other ones. So it was never seen as the redheaded stepchild of the rest of film and television. Which again, it's coming back into its own now. I think the A movies are now basically B movie science fiction. But that was, so I was growing up with a healthy respect for science fiction. My mom and my dad basically forced me to watch Doctor Who, whether I was, you know, screaming and crying. But you know, I loved it. I loved how terrifying that stuff was. And look at it now. I wonder why. But you know, it's characters. You get caught up in those characters, and I was sucked in by this fantastic Doctor Who character who seemed to always have an answer, but was still somehow at risk, and was always had a good comeback, always had some technical explanation. And the other thing that was very smart was TVO that showed it here because the British shows were either too long or too short for the American schedule. They didn't always sort of end on the hours as all the American stuff did. There was a chunk of time that they had to make up, and they made up for it by having this fantastic, wild-haired scientist explaining some of the technologies and how they could be real, or talking about technologies that related to this, to Doctor Who. So for me, there was no way of distinguishing to me between science fiction and reality. They were all part of the same thing. So I think that really got my imagination going, and I think has really helped to sort of craft me as a nerd and as an actor.
Right. You know, there is an interesting distinction that we can make here, because especially in the United States, there's a lot of stuff that gets grouped into sci-fi, which really doesn't. It's not really sci-fi. It's sci-fi-ish. Yeah. They might set it in the future. They might set it in space. But a real sci-fi work, be it a book, a movie, TV show, whatever it might be, it appeals to, I think you alluded to this with you trying to make that sonic screwdriver, it appeals to people who try to figure things out. It makes us feel better when we think, okay, no, there's actual physics behind that. That's why there's a Star Trek The Next Generation technical manual. Why people are explaining things like the Epstein drive on The Expanse. That's why people are actually coming up with ideas. Oh, no, a ZPM from the Stargate universe, zero point, of course. If you can extract energy down to the zero point, you can basically go down to the very lowest energy state, and that's an infinite amount of energy. It's amazing to hear people talk about these things in terms that are not sci-fi. They actually try to explain what they see. And I think that's one of those things that it marks true sci-fi. When it gets us excited on that level, you know you've hit the right note.
Yeah, I think it's twofold. I think there's a wonderful escapism to science fiction there's this, it's a plausible, especially when there's sort of plausible futures for me, that always, it really excites me. So there's that aspect. And then, as you say, I think there was a great quote. I was talking to these guys at OpenBCI, these brain computer interface guys, brilliant bunch of guys. And Connor is one of the guys who created and ran that company, who runs that company. And he said that he felt that science fiction was really the first stage of engineering, and that's the dreaming phase. And you can see that. I mean, all of the technology that we use today, you know, it's been influenced by, I mean, mainly by Star Trek. I mean, right. That's like a lot of that stuff comes from that. But you know, the people whose interests were piqued by the science fiction will go on to invent that stuff or to create their own versions of it, really, as you say.
Yeah. And it's almost a game. It's a game for us to see if we could create something that we saw in a sci-fi program, which then reinforces that sci-fi program. We form emotional bonds to the sci-fi that we love. We really do. I mean, it's stronger than any attachment to any show I've ever seen. When you find characters that you love, when you find a storyline that you can sympathize with, you're in, and you're in all the way. Even if it becomes a show that you hate, you're still in, which is amazing to me because you don't normally find that in the industry of entertainment.
It's true. You know, I take I take great glee in hating movies. Like, I will watch movies. I'll watch them twice because they're so bad. You know what I mean? Like, it's true. I think I don't know what it is. It's, you know, besides, you know, it's like some self-torture of some sort, but there's something to be said for, I think, again, because I don't think it was always taken very seriously, there's a lot of terrible science fiction out there. And also, science fiction tends to get blurred into horror, which is a shame, and which is a pit that I fell into as well, where, you know, people don't want just science fiction because that's just going to be nerds. And we want to open it up to more people. So it's got to have romance. It's got to have comedy. It's got to have, you know what I mean? Like, they're scared of just science fiction. And pure science fiction, when it's done right, is just, as you say, you just lose yourself in it. There was a scene in Stargate, I remember, where we were introducing my sister to the whole concept of Star Trek, of Star Trek. I'm past my dad.
Well, which, by the way, editor's note here, the actress who played his sister in Stargate was actually Hewlett's sister.
Is actually, yeah, Kate. Yeah, I have to admit it now. I never used to, but now she's on TV. I have to sort of, yeah, she was fantastic. But she had, I was so sort of, to me, there was this sort of weird moment where I saw her, I mean, poor Kate was sort of pulled off a plane and thrown onto this set and told to look at a dot on a green screen and go like, wow. But I knew obviously what they were going to put in there. And I just kept thinking, like, this is what people love about Stargate. You've got these fun characters who get to constantly remind the audience that this could be real. There may be stuff out there, you know? And if it's not Stargate, it's, you know, there's something like it. There's, you know, the military's up to something. And it's just, you get those shivers, those moments where you get those little shivers and you're like, oh, that's a world. Even if it doesn't exist, I am willing to will it into existence, you know? Oops.
You're
Someone's at my front door. That's my ring.
That's your Ring video doorbell, which, by the way, is a sponsor of the TV network. Actually, I want to use that. Can we step behind the camera just a bit? Because I get a chuckle every time I watch that episode, which, by the way, I have all the DVDs, and they basically just play on loop at my workstation because I always like having something running whenever I'm editing. It makes me giggle thinking you pulled your real sister into your universe. This was a universe that you were crafting. You're one of the stars. You're one of the main actors. You bring her in to do, it's a large role, and it actually becomes a recurring role.
Yeah. It wouldn't have if she hadn't done a good job.
That's right. Exactly.
She'd have died pretty quick if she hadn't done a good job.
But there had to be a little bit of that brotherly, yeah, you're coming into my world now. You have to take your cues from me, right? I mean,
oh, I laud it over all the time. Yeah, I still do that. I welcomed her into this world too, as far as I'm concerned. So she owes me all the time. No, what's funny about that was there was a scene far earlier on where I mentioned having a distant relationship with a brother. And while we were shooting, I said, look, I'm not asking you to cast a sister or anything, but I have five younger sisters. I just think it'd be much funnier for me and possibly for other people if it was a sister that I had, you know, this issue with. And they're like, yeah, whatever, fine. Stupid actors have to change every line. But they went with it. And then I made Dog's Breakfast because I wanted to play with directing, but also because I wanted to show off Kate, because I just thought, like, Kate is like the funniest woman I've ever met. Like, she just, for some reason, she's just got this really fun, warped, twisted sense of humor. And we are just merciless to each other. Like, we shouldn't like each other, but for some reason we do. And people are always shocked. People who don't have siblings are shocked by the way we treat each other. The reality is that's what it's like having sisters, you know, or brothers or whatever.
You are one of the few cast members of the Stargate universe that has actually been in all three TV shows. You've been in Stargate SG-1. You were a star. You were one of the main roles in Stargate Atlantis. And then you also had a role in Stargate Universe.
Which was terrifying.
It's kind of, but there was such a shift between Stargate Atlantis and Stargate Universe. And I know that was intentional. And honestly, I miss Stargate Universe. I wish they had a chance to wrap up that story.
The hardest thing that they had going for them was that they had Stargate in front of their name.
Exactly.
Like, I think if you had just been called Universe and people could discover it on its own, it would have been, I think it would have run for ages. I mean, the problem was, I think that because it was Stargate, and it was coming out of Atlantis, which is very much a very different show. I mean, I used to joke, they didn't like it, but I used to joke that we were the Disney of science fiction. Of course, now that's Star Wars. But, the idea that it was like, you know, we were like the family getting together to sit down and watch science fiction, like I did Doctor Who. And at the time, everyone wanted to be Battlestar, you know, and Battlestar, my God, I love Battlestar, but you're not as a family sitting down with the kids to watch Battlestar. That's a lot to explain.
That would be a weird family. If
that'd be really weird. I'm sure we're basically there. Like, we watch Stranger Things. So, you know, for anyone coming out of Atlantis and then diving into SGU, it would have been a shock because they're just not the same shows. It's a beautiful – Stargate Universe is beautiful, and the acting's fantastic. The writing's gorgeous. It's just a very different show than Atlantis. And I was very worried when they mentioned me coming in, because I was like, well, what is this? Like, what are we going to mash them all together again now? I mean, how do I fit in this world? Like, I'd seen Universe, and I was like, this is not a McKay's world. Like, and Brad was just – I mean, Brad's a brilliant writer. Walked this beautiful line of comedy. There's still McKay there, but he worked in the universe world. And I just thought I thought he did a fantastic job of that. And I wish I'd done more. I mean, they were talking about, if it had gone again, I think they were talking about coming back, but I loved it. But as I say, I was really nervous going into that because that wasn't my show. And, you know, and I didn't know anybody, and I felt kind of weird because you're sort of like, I know all the crew, and I know, like, this is my joke was like, you're eating my sandwiches, you know, which was misconstrued, by the way. I actually, Lou Diamond Phillips was like, so is it okay that we're eating your sandwiches now? And I was like, and I'd forgotten I'd said it. I was like, I don't know what you're talking about. I was like, yeah, have a sandwich. Sure. I don't, like, you know, whatever. And he reminded me that I'd said this, and I guess I tweeted or something. And I was like, well, now you know me, you must understand it's only about the food. I guess it's nothing personal. It's just that I liked having craft service around. But so there was definitely this weird kind of us and them feeling coming in there. And I was definitely on their turf, but they were lovely, you know. And again, the performance is like, God, Louis's fantastic. Like, God, that guy can turn it on and off. Like, it's like a switch. It's amazing. And then, you know, LDP, they were all just, they were, I didn't want to leave once I started, you know, so.
Well, you and Lou Diamond have another honor that both of you, there are very few of you. I think it's you, Lou Diamond Phillips, Amanda, who have played two versions of yourself in the same episode.
Ha.
Right. Which is, that's kind of cool.
It's, they're the worst episodes. to shoot there, just, they're hell. They're hell to shoot. You know, it's like, there's something very telling in that I couldn't stand my double. I was so horrible, this poor guy. This guy came in and I was like, and he just, it's impossible that anyone is going to work as hard and be as, you know, attentive to what is McKay than McKay, obviously. And I just thought it was so funny that I basically started channeling my own McKay towards this poor guy who was playing me. And I wouldn't do it like that. We need to go again. This is, why is he doing that? You know? It was, oh God, it's, I mean, they're fantastic episodes. They're like actors' dreams. Like, you know, people ask me who my favorite person was to work opposite in Stargate. I get to say myself. But boy, the logistics of shooting that is just, especially back then too, because again, motion controlled cameras.
Right.
And back then they were, oh my God, there was like a village showed up of people to control all these things. And I just kept thinking like, are you programming it with punch cards? Like, it just had that feeling of those big glass air conditioned rooms back in the day of the mainframes, you know?
Right, right. But I mean, when Lou Diamond Phillips played two versions of himself on the same episode, it was a time jump. So I don't know if he was actually, no, he was never on screen twice. He was never with himself. Amanda had to do it when she had a replicator double. And then you, of course, had to do it with the alternate universe, Rodney. Now that you say that you've got these computer controlled cameras, how difficult was it to set up those kinds of shots where you actually have to interact with yourself?
Well, that's it. You've got the timing. It becomes less about acting and more about just this technical stuff, which, again, is I sort of pride myself on that because that's what I grew up doing. Like, we, you know, one of Vincenzo's first films, it was so expensive to get a sound camera that we would shoot on these old, he wanted to shoot 16 mil, and we had these old, like, wind up 16 mil cameras that had like an electric motor sort of jammed on it, and it sounded like a sewing machine. So we recorded the dialogue first, and then I lip-synced to the dialogue on camera.
Wow.
So it was stuff like that where I just assumed that acting was supposed to be the most awkward, complicated, you know, and disjointed experience. And so when you come into science fiction, I you know, that to me, that's like, great, what do you got? You know, like, there's a tennis ball, perfect. What is it? Great, dinosaur, fine. You know, like, that's, to me, there's an art to that. And I really pride myself on that. I love that. I love that challenge. To me, the more lines you give me, the harder they are to say, the more critical it is that it all happens in one take. Like, I hate it and will push back and I'll be the grumpiest jerk you can imagine. But boy, I love it when you get it right.
Yeah. Well, it's that feeling. It's the, yeah, swished it. That's the take.
It's the equivalent of like extreme sports only for acting.
Right. Let's make it clear that you actually had a career before Stargate. You did a couple of TV shows. You had your first movie as Chucky in The Dark Side. One of my cult favorites is Cube. This is before Hypercube. Yeah. This, you were the architect. You were one of the first characters that we see on screen.
There is no way out of here.
There is no way out of here. And but of course, everyone really started to know you as Dr. McKay on Stargate SG-1. You were brought in for a two-part episode, and you were really playing opposite of Amanda. You were the two smart people in the room who had an immediate love-hate relationship, which I love. It was one of my favorite episodes of all time. However, we get to see Dr. McKay kind of evolve from that first two-parter to your a few more exposures in SG-1 until you take the lead in Stargate Atlantis. How did that happen? How much were you able to shape the character as you went on? And you start saying, well, look, I'm no longer just a one-off. I now have to be part of this universe. This has to be my story.
It's interesting. I mean, the writers handle that stuff. I mean, that's their, you know, the credit, the true sort of credit for that series has to go to the writers, because when you create these characters and keeping them alive on a weekly basis, I mean, they did a magnificent job of that. And I think I like won on that, because I was playing this weird sort of hybrid of a few of the writers, you know, because writers are very, you know, writers are like, they're like little gods, you know, they've got their worlds and they control lives and they, you know, so a lot of the McKayisms came out of, I used to joke that I would be, McKay is basically just some kind of a child of Cooper and Brad Wright, because they're both just so smart, so, you know, just sort of, I can't put a word on it. Like just this is their sarcasm. They're snarky. They're just wonderfully smart, funny people to be around. And so, they were dripping McKay before he was even existing. But the real, I think real, another real sort of genesis for McKay was working with Amanda, because Amanda, I had known of Amanda. I'd sort of run into Amanda, I think, a couple of times when we were both in Toronto, but she'd been, you know, out west for ages on SG1. She was so welcoming, and she is so welcoming. It's not just me. I mean, she was with everybody. She was incredibly good at making you feel comfortable. She's also in a position where, you know, if you get a regular actor who doesn't want to play, you're dead. I mean, you're basically, you know, after a while, the leads of the show start to run the show, because, you know, they know their characters better than anybody. And she was so giving in that she allowed me to really push that in a way that I think had it been half-assed, it just wouldn't have been the same. So really, I think, you know, you have to give credit to her. She is. She's a uniquely wonderful individual, Amanda. She's, you know, I mean, she's obviously gorgeous, but I think a lot of that comes from just what a wonderful person she is. I mean, I use this term, you know, the people light up a room, and she's one of those people who just walks in and it's like you can't take your eyes off her. And it's not just looks. There's something in there. You know what I mean?
Well, another thing about Amanda is that she kind of broke down some of the stereotypes and the tropes that you got in sci-fi before her, because you used to have characters like a Ripley, who was badass, and that was her thing. She was a badass. She was a warrior. And then you would have other characters who were very smart, but that's really all they contributed. She had that interesting character where she was a genius and she would solve things on her own and save the team. And she would also be the person in the firefight. That really made it, was like, oh yeah, yeah, that character actually works. That makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, it's funny that there's that it's funny to see that sort of shift throughout television and seeing it more and more now. Yeah. I mean, it's amazing. I do get a little frustrated sometimes when people talk about like this, oh, why, you know, there were no good female leads. And I was like, well, Ripley is a great example of a good female lead. I mean, right. You know, I think science fiction is great at pushing those boundaries, or can be great at pushing those boundaries. It can also be terrible. Because, as I say, there's often the demands of distribution that they want, you know, half naked women on the and a burning helicopter in the back of a shot, you know, whether that makes sense or not.
On one hand, you get the women of the expanse, who are all strong, incredible warriors. And the other hand, you get Cleopatra 25-25. It's like, okay,
exactly.
Well,
exactly.
Yeah, hit or miss.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny. My wife was actually asking about Barbarella the other night and saying that I'm curious to see how that would hold up. I don't know where that sits in, like, was that progressive or was it incredibly, you know, I mean, like, I'm curious to sort of see it again for that reason. You know, you purely for that reason, of course.
So much of that movie is based on whether or not it's self-aware at that particular moment. If it's tongue in cheek, it makes sense. If they were directing it straight, you kind of scratch your head and go, I'm not exactly sure what you're going for right now.
Yeah, the 70s or the 60s, I guess. Yeah. I mean, it's when you talk about The Expanse. I know I was gloating about it on Twitter the other day. I saw the first episode for season 3.
Jealous.
Oh my God, those effects are so gorgeous.
I love that series. We haven't had a hard sci-fi series like that in a while. That's just immediately likable. And some of my favorite series of Battlestar Galactica, Stargate, of course, Dark Matter. And now we've got The Expanse, and that's where I spend my sci-fi money. Yeah.
Oh, it's stunning.
I do want to go on a little bit. I want to go behind the scenes of Stargate just a tiny tad before we move on, because you've done a lot since then. But can we take just a moment to thank another sponsor?
Absolutely.
Fantastic.
Of course, you go for it.
All right. Well, folks, you know, we here at TWiT, we are filled with entrepreneurs. We're filled with people who have done a lot with our careers. We've moved from spot to spot. We've done contracting. We've followed our passions and our dreams. But sometimes those passions and dreams need to get paid. And that's not always fun. I mean, I'm not a money person. I'm not a finance person. I know that people like Leo Laporte, we love making content. We love creating things. But when it's time to get paid, it's best to have someone who actually knows how to do it, which is why we're so happy to have FreshBooks as a sponsor of Triangulation. Now, this episode is brought to you by FreshBooks. And they understand that tax season is a stressful time for freelancers and small business owners, but it doesn't have to be. You can fight your tax fears with FreshBooks, the easy-to-use cloud accounting software for small business owners. Their intuitive dashboard will give you quick access to your spending, your outstanding balances, your total profit, and other accounting reports so that you'll know how you're doing at any given moment. FreshBooks automatically connects to your bank account and updates expenses daily, and that means that dashboard will give you a at-a-glance look of how you're doing. What invoices do you have pending? What money do you have coming in? What money do you have going out? And with FreshBooks, you can send professional-looking invoices in seconds. No more using an old standard generic Word template to ask for your money to get paid. You can save time accepting credit cards online and get paid an average of 2 times faster. It also means no more chasing clients for payments or waiting in line at the bank. You can accept credit cards directly from your invoice. You can see what invoices have been sent, viewed and paid, as well as overdue and outstanding. FreshBooks allows you to create proposals with rich text content, images, customizable sections, and more. And FreshBooks makes it easy to bill for time by client and by specific project. Well, FreshBooks recently added Spanish and Dutch languages as options for invoices, estimates, and proposals. The bottom line is that FreshBooks lets you look like a big firm. It lets you look like your accounting department is on it when it's really just you and FreshBooks. And with the FreshBooks app, you can stay connected to your clients and keep tabs on your business no matter where you are. Take a picture of a receipt, upload it, and let FreshBooks do the rest. Our payment schedules can now be set up from the FreshBooks iOS app, and you can now see attachments or existing proposals. The additional push notifications on iOS, you can be notified when a client hasn't viewed an invoice, estimate, or proposal in 7 days. That's very important if you're trying to get paid. And when a client comments and when an invoice becomes overdue, you can set yourself up for a stress-free tax season next year with FreshBooks. It all starts now, because remember, you got to start thinking about the next year so that it's not as much of a nightmare as it is this year. Set yourself up from payment reminders to late fees. It allows you to automate as much or as little as you'd like to and get back to what you love doing. And for us, that means making content. Here's what we want you to do. We want you to try FreshBooks free for 30 days at FreshBooks.com/triangulation and enter triangulation in the How Did You Hear About Us section. Again, that's FreshBooks.com/triangulation. FreshBooks.com/triangulation. And we thank FreshBooks for their support of Triangulation. We're back with David Hewlett. Hewlett, what precipitated you being a lead on Stargate Atlantis? Because, I mean, you were a fun character in SG-1, but they could have gone anyway. What made them say, no, McKay is the character we want as the main science guy lead?
Well, they didn't. I mean, that was the funny thing. One of the first things I read when I got the part and they sort of announced it was on chat. And someone said, like, of all the characters they could have picked, why would you pick such a jerk? And I was like, I literally responded, was like, I know, isn't it crazy? Like, you know, it was shocking to me. But what was funny was originally the character was an African-American astrophysicist with attitude, basically. and I'd bothered every member of my, you know, agencies and managers and said, like, look, they've got a new series going. Could you let them know that I loved working on it? And I was literally just angling to have an episode or two, you know? And they're like, yeah, no, of course we'll get to you. They never happened. No one ever followed up. And then I got an email from one of the casting agents saying like, oh, you know, by the way, they were talking about how great it would be to have you on the show, you know, if only there was a, you know, a part for you type thing. And then there was a casting shift or something. And this is one of the sad, very sad things about the film and television industry is that it's like going to a grocery store and having to pick all of the right, you know, we need a woman, we need a minority, right. And that's how a lot of these things work, where there's this struggle to try to, you know, maximize eyeballs and all that kind of stuff. Anyways, what had happened was one of the characters had been cast against the original type, and so I got this call saying, look, will you come and audition for this character? And I was like, audition? You know, like, sure, great. You know, like, I'm going in for someone else. Like, it seemed weird because McKay was such a sort of, he was a very recognizable character. So I went in for this audition, and the poor casting agent was like, okay, no, they don't want McKay. They want this guy. So let's just, maybe you could just try to sort of just, you know, and I'd say, yes, yeah, no, of course. And I do it exactly the same way again. I just met more and more McKay every time. And sort of in frustration, they sort of went, yeah, okay, great, thank you, you know, and off I went. And I thought, oh, God, I've either completely screwed this up, or as it turned out, they were like, yeah, we're bringing you in. You're not playing Ingram. It's McKay. And I was like, of course I'm playing McKay. Who else? You couldn't bring me back and not have me play McKay. So it was, you know, again, I feel like to some extent growing up on science fiction, you know how I feel like if I wasn't a part of this, I am anyway. I mean, as a part of it or without a part of it, I'd be at these conventions. This is what I grew up with. I love this stuff. I feel like I know how the mind of a fan works because that's who I, first and foremost, that's what I was. So I knew that there's no way they were going to have McKay show up and not be McKay. It's never going to happen. So, you know, so that worked out incredibly well. I mean, I had $65 in my bank account.
Wow.
I was completely broke. There was a debate on the contract, and I was like, okay, nope, we're not doing it. That's it. I'm playing hardball here. And I sort of walked out of the house and went, oh my God, I'm completely broke. What am I doing? And sure enough, they came back and it worked out. And, you know, it's what a wonderful way to change your life. I mean, it was just, this is the nature of what we do, is that just like one phone call, it's like a lottery. You know, I'd love to say it's all talent, but so much of it is just luck and timing. And, you know, I mean, you just got to be ready to go when it happens. You know?
Well, so. you're being humble, but I mean, if McKay had been played poorly, or if Ingram had been played poorly, or if the lead science for Atlantis had been a putz, it wouldn't have become a sci-fi meme. And McKay is a sci-fi meme. I mean, you have to admit that. People understand what you mean when you're talking about, oh, yeah, the McKay character. It means the brilliant person who, and Patrick Delahanty, who's on staff here at Twit, he says he loves counting up all the episodes in which McKay either was going to cause the destruction of the universe or stop the destruction of the universe. And most of the time, they were in the same episodes.
Both, yeah. Well, yeah,
did both things at the same time.
Hey, things got to get broke to fix them.
But, I mean, it's a role now. I mean, there's the McKay role. And that means you nailed it. That means you did exactly what it was supposed to be. And yeah, I heard the chat rooms light up. In fact, we had Aspire in our chat room saying, I wouldn't have thought McKay for Atlantis because he always seemed like a very unlikable character. And that just means you did a fantastic job turning him into a likable character. And that took several seasons, because that first season you were still the McKay from SG-1. And then you this is McKay from Atlantis.
Yeah, I always sort of joked about it because it was like everyone else, they were presenting a character, whereas I was just excusing a character. Like I was just, you learned why he was the way he was, as opposed to presenting him as a certain way. We were sort of unraveling him, which was always really fun. And again, I thank you. I look, it's a dream role. Like it was the, you know, certainly, you know, one of, if not the most, you know, fun character to play. I mean, my wife would give me 15 minutes to lose McKay when I got home, because I'd come home with still snapping my fingers and stuff. And but he was, you know, I think a big part of that is because he he's the nerd in all of us. I mean, he's the guy who wants to be the first person with his hand up and answer the question. He's the guy at the party who says everything you wanted to say, but just wasn't, you know, but you've got the social graces not to. I mean, he's just a fantastic character. And those don't come along a lot. I mean, when I first did that part back in SG1 days, I was living in LA again, like a struggling actor. And I remember going to like this cheap taco place and this guy came up and said, "You're in that show." And I was like, no, I'm not in it. I don't know what you're talking about. He goes, no, the show with the blonde girl and shit. And I was like, what? What are you talking about? He goes, the science fiction and I was like, oh, you mean Stargate? He's like, Stargate, I got that. You know, and my first time I was ever recognized, like really truly recognized from television was SG-1, like one episode of SG-1. Yeah. And I was like,
it was a great episode.
It was fantastic.
That's why for me, because I didn't hear about any of the murmurs until after I saw the pilot of Atlantis, because I was really, I wanted to block myself out. I was excited. There's another series that's spinning off. And when I saw you on screen, I said, oh, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. He's the only one who's the equal of Carter. So, of course, you would send him off to another universe. He's the guy.
I'll give you that.
All right.
And what's funny is that first episode, he was Ingram.
That's right.
I don't think he even rewrote it. Like, I think it was literally, like, I was saying Ingram's lines, you know? So he was a lot more low-key. He was, you know, there were little things, but you know, for the most part, he was kind of a different character, you know?
Right. Let's step back behind the camera. I just wanted to know a little bit about this. You sit down with your cast, and you all get the scripts. Sci-fi... and Stargate and Expanse and all the other great sci-fis are known for killing off characters. That's kind of what they do. It adds drama and it also adds punch to episodes. What's the first thing that you do when you get the script? Do you just go through all your lines? You find out how your character is? I mean, it's not as bad as Game of Thrones where literally anyone can die in any episode. But what was that like for you?
That's funny. I mean, I was so involved in it, and I think I was so McKay, I never believed for a second they were ever going to get rid of me. I think I was just – I felt sort of strangely untouchable because I felt I was a part of that. I was a part of the world of our creators, if that makes sense. But it's definitely one of those things where you go – you know, you are so at the mercy of the writers. I mean – you pick up a script and it's like, you know, oh, you're naked on the floor. You're like, what? Oh, God, I should have gone to a gym 50 years ago. You know, like you just don't know. There was an older actor who sadly just passed away, Bruce Gray, fantastic guy. He did some Star Treks as well. He said, you know, because he was always bugging me about, you got to go to the gym. You got to be fit. You got to be, he said, because you just never know when they're going to ask you to take your clothes off, you know? And I always said, well, there's two types of people in the world. People look good naked and people look funny naked. I'm a funny naked.
So. And if you're going to be funny, you might as well be funny all the way.
Exactly.
I want to know about that. Is there vengeance that writers will take on an actor they don't like?
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, wouldn't you? I mean, gosh. I mean, I always thought it was one of those, you walk that line where you're like, you know, like it just like, why would you bite the hand that feeds you? You know, I think that, yeah, definitely. I think there's definitely a sense of that. And you know, and there's a weird kind of office politics that sets in when you're on a show for as long as everyone is involved in that show.
Right.
I think if people got out of line, they, you know, you'd sometimes get slapped with an episode, you know? So, you know, and I think they took great glee in making my life misery. Because I think that's what my character, what I'm good at is, you know, is sort of hilariously miserable, you know? So I feel like, you know, there's definitely a bit of an edge to some of the stuff for sure. And and writers are thieves. Like they just, you know, and I know this even from my own writing where you're constantly just like, ooh, I'll take a little bit of that guy and a little bit of that her over here. And like, you know, you're constantly, you know, you're not even conversing with people. You're just like recording. You know what I mean? Like so sometimes you see yourself showing up in scripts in not always the most flattering way. So,
all right. I could talk about Stargate forever, but you do have a life beyond Stargate. Of course,
not really.
There was Debug, the movie that you directed with Jason Momoa.
It almost killed me.
Okay, explain that.
Oh, it was miserable. What a miserable experience. It was one of those things. I feel like I had done Dog's Breakfast, which was a true labor of love. Like, I had basically paid for everything myself. And what I didn't pay for myself, people would come in and said, I want to be a part of this. It was like doing a play in the bar, and everyone was just so, you know, damn happy to be there. And we just had such a great time doing it. And it was just such a wonderful experience throughout. You know, then it gets picked up by MGM. Like, we made it for like $160,000. And then MGM picks it up for international distribution, you know, and it's over $2 million or something they've made on this film already. So it was just a wonderful experience. And then we went to make this. I wanted to make a film, and I feel like this is where you got to be so careful with the industry, where you start trying to second guess what people want from you, and you go like, "Well, no, but I'm a sci-fi guy who I should do this kind of thing," and you start. And I feel like that was a script that I tried to make everybody happy. And then when we got into the actual process of making it, which was just ridiculously short prep time, and you know, there was like a full rewrite like the weekend before we started shooting because the lighting had screwed up, and it was like anything that could go wrong did go wrong. And I sort of assumed that, because having done some directing before, I knew that was what I was getting into. But this was just on another level, and it was those were dark times. Like, it was, you know, and at the end of the day, I came out of it and I you know, and it's not the film. I set out to make a film about Hal from 2001, but from his perspective. Like, you're supposed to feel sorry for him. He's supposed to be, the good guy. You know, my point was always like, if Clint Eastwood was playing Hal, he'd be kicking those dirty humans off his spaceship. You know, like, he's like, you know, it would be, you know, he was just protecting his home turf. And it ended up being, you know, Final Destination in space, with a bunch of like half naked, you know, cliches running around. And it was sort of a painful process, but a really important lesson to learn. And I see this happen to people going out of LA all the time, where they go down and they are themselves, and they go down, and they try to then create something that they think people want. And the true power in Hollywood is originality, is being yourself. And for actors, that's the hardest thing in the world to do. And when you take that and put that into writing and directing, it can be murder. You know what I mean? Like, it really just, you know, I mean, I learned a ton of stuff. I made some friendships for life. I lost some friendships for life, which is really, to me, films aren't worth that. I learned how important it is to be true to what you're, to who you are, and how you want to be seen. And I think this, unfortunately, with film, you know, those things that will now be around forever. That will be, you know, every mistake that was in that film hurts me. Whereas in Dog's Breakfast, every mistake in that film, and there are many of them, I laugh at, because I go like, yeah, you know what? Those were all my decisions. Those were like, I made the totally stupid decision to do that. Fantastic. Whereas with Debug, you know, it was supposed to be, you know, it was, all that stuff was supposed to be looked after. It was supposed to be handled. It was I kept being told, oh, now you're making a real movie. And I was like, what? I liked my real movie, you know? So it was really interesting. I mean, it's again, I would never want to go through it again, but I thought it was very telling. And weirdly, it really, like, jump forward to Shape of Water, talking to Guillermo del Toro about making films and how he'd gone through that process with other films where he was tearing himself apart because he was making someone else's movie that he thought was his, you know what I mean? And just how he realized that you don't make a movie, you don't do anything. Like, he applies this to movies, but the reality is I now apply this to everything. You don't do anything unless you will die if you don't do it. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, it's not about needing to or wanting to or what, or that's the right idea or the right thing to be doing. You gotta, like, it's gotta be you, not just be what you want. And that was so eye-opening to me and so inspiring to hear him talk about having similar experiences, you know, on brilliant films, you know, admittedly, we weren't debugs, you know, but it was that it was, I sort of came out of the tunnel working on Guillermo's movie and realized sort of what I'd learned, if that makes sense.
Well, that's all part of the lessons. Yeah. All the lessons learned.
That's it. Well, that's it. And again, and that's the other thing is, you know, you live your life, and if you can, if you want, you can go down. I went to some dark places after Debug, and the reality was getting out of that was realizing, wait, you made a movie. How cool is that? You got, somebody gave you money to make a movie. You know, it sucked, but you know, that's, you're doing what you, so what? The people make bad movies. Let's, you know, move on. Let's make something else. You know what I mean? So I keep thinking of Ed Wood, you know, oh, you hated my last movie. Well, you're going to love my next one. You know, like it's, you know, it's part of the game, but there's a frustration. I think for a nerd like me, you want to do everything. You want to, like, I'm used to being able, I like playing with circuit boards and building things, and you're there for the beginning, the middle, and the end. And filmmaking's not like that. Filmmaking isn't like going up to a canvas and making and doing a painting and going, there you go, what do you think? You know, it's such, there's so much input from so many different people. And what so inspires me about independent film and this, like the Red Giant stuff, like going back to Hologram and things, was that we're getting, it's reducing. Technology's allowing us to make these things smaller and smaller, allowing people like me, and more importantly, I think, future generations, younger kids, or even just young people, to create stuff with far more control than we could ever do. Look at YouTube. You know, YouTube's a great example of people doing what they want to do themselves, by themselves. They've created a persona, a brand, a business, a passion. You know, it's so inspiring to me. Like, it's just, it's so, like, that's a future I want to be a part of.
I would love to talk about Hunsaker in the Rise of the Planet of the Apes. I would love to talk about Fleming in The Shape of Water, which, by the way, we're all going to be watching this Sunday to see if it's definitely going to come home with some awards. I know which one I wanted to get, by the way, fantastic job. Yeah, Fleming was note perfect. although everyone keeps commenting, where's his mustache?
I know. Here's the thing is, I'm working on the Einstein hair, and I'm subtly trying to grow the beard, the mustache as well. But Jane keeps catching me and making me shave. So,
I'd love to go into those, but there is one thing I think we need to talk about, and that is the fact that you are a geek. You are a huge geek. You are a real geek. In fact, we have people in the chat room saying, you know, he doesn't come across to me as an actor, and that's a good thing. It's yes, because you are actually a geek, and we can prove that. Because of Upgrade Required. This, I love this. The mission statement, you said, you're on a quest to render disabilities obsolete through technology. Tell me about Upgrade Required.
I met this guy, Q, who's in the suit at the back there, because I had put out this silly little video that said that I had wanted to be Han Solo, but I ended up being C-3PO. It was sort of a science fiction, like, you know, like taking stock of your life and all this kind of stuff. And he got back and said, well, you know, I wanted to move. I can't. So I want to be a cyborg.
Okay.
And I was like, what the heck? You know, nerd alert. Don't make eye contact. Avoid this one. But then I was sort of drawn in and I checked out some of his stuff. And I was so intrigued by this kid who was just, you know, just out there. You know, like making a name for himself on YouTube. He's actually debunking religious organizations, which was interesting at like at 14 or whatever.
Like
going
head to
head with hypocrisy, basically, of these organizations, some of them. So I just got in touch with him, and I started talking to him, and my wife jokes that I was kind of jealous because there's this guy who has access to the complete, you know, the collective knowledge of the human race. And he's plugged into this thing, thanks to the internet, most of the day. And all the boring administrative stuff, as I would call it, you know, like living your life, is has to be, by nature of his disease, it has to be looked after by other people or technology or whatever. And so as a result, he's almost more human than human. Like he's the quintessentially what us humans like to think of themselves as these thinking, brilliant, machines that can solve any problem, you know, not think of ourselves as machines, but, you know, that we like to think of ourselves as these sort of intelligent beings, really, and that strangely, that really caught my attention. And we ended up talking a lot. And my wife eventually said, look, you know, you talk to this guy more than you talk to half your friends. Why don't you make a film about this? And I thought, oh, fantastic. But weirdly, for the wrong reasons. I wasn't so interested in making the movie as I was interested in making the robotics and stuff that would be required for this. So as the years have gone, I've sort of changed my perspective on it. And now I really want a Mythbusters style half hour where the family can sit down, but instead of, you know, and we'll do a lot of blowing up things and burning things and things as well, but with an eye towards, you know, using some of these technologies that are available to solve disability related problems. And they're so cool, because like, who doesn't want a robot? Like, who didn't grow up wanting a robot? That's happening now. That stuff's available now. And I keep meeting, my idea behind it was that with Upgrade, I kept meeting people like Q, or people who were interested in helping people like Q, or people with other disability related things, or people with other technologies that they wanted to use towards solving problems in the world. And I thought, what a great sort of, you know, I mean, it's a film because that's what I do. But the reality is, I want it to be more than that. And I'm still struggling to figure out what that is. And part of an offshoot of that was trying to bring this sort of my excitement about technology to kids, so that when they see that they're building things in school, they can be building things that will change the world, or change the world for people that they know. You know, there's a kid in our class who has a partially formed arm, and apparently she's not, doesn't like talking about it, and in fact doesn't wear her prosthetic arm. And you know, we're in doing our Tech Terrace thing, and one day, and she says, you know, I've got a robotic arm. And I was like, oh, that's cool. Like, I didn't even notice. Like, she just wore long sweaters and stuff. And I said, oh, cool. Like, where, like, were you at home, or what's the deal? She goes, no, it's in my locker. I was like, well, go get it. What are you doing? So she comes up, clunks this thing down on the desk, and goes like, why can't mine do that? Because we had this little like claw that could work on its own, and it could rotate around and stuff. And she's stuck with this like 1970s, you know, prosthetic that doesn't even match her skin tone. You know what I mean? Like, it was frustrating to her and to me that this stuff wasn't available to her. So, and you know, and that got her excited about programming. Like, where's that connection? You know what I mean? Like, she started programming this robotic arm to do things, and she went from wanting to be a soccer star to wanting to be a programmer and a soccer star. So, you know, it's just that kind of stuff. These things keep coming up. I keep finding people who I go, oh, I know somebody who could help with that. And we sort of put it together. And so that's what Upgrade Required is. Upgrade Required is a sort of a series, I think, that will hopefully shine some light on this and get some attention and make people realize how exciting and fun this stuff can be. But that my ulterior motive is to actually be able to do this for real and continue doing it.
I have to say, you've got me excited. You've got a lot of people in the Twit community excited about that, because that's exactly what we want to see. We want to see something like that. I mean, we love Builders. We love Mythbusters. If you can combine that, we're in.
Well, that's it. And also just to show that everyone can sit down and watch, because I think it's important, you know, that kids see. I think it's less important to teach kids how things work exactly than it is just to inspire them, so that they understand that they can make these things work, or that they can do these things. You know, there's such a focus on getting the nuts and bolts of the essential out of the way. But I think at the risk of losing that sort of that childish, the science fiction wonder of creating your own worlds. You know what I mean? And that's where this stuff comes in. This is science fiction, but it's happening. You know, like EA are building prosthetic arms that are straight out of their games, you know, straight out of their cyborg games and stuff, which now I can't remember the name of it now. Is it Deus Ex or X Deus? Right, or what do right. I never get that right. Ex Machina, that's it. Yeah. So, you know what I mean? Like, that's like, this stuff is happening. Iron Man, you know, like, you know, Iron Man shows up and delivers an Iron Man arm. You know what I mean? Robert Downey Jr. is there giving kids arms. I like, this is a world. This is a world I want to be a part of, you know?
Oh, by the way, I've always thought that you should be part of the Marvel Universe, so we need to work on that if you could.
Fine with that. I would be happy with that. Yes.
We have been speaking with David Hewlett. He is, as we wrote, by the way, we chose his lower third. He is a maker. He is a movie star. He is a super genius.
I can put that on a business card.
It's yours. It's yours. Now, if you could, please tell the folks where they can find you, where they can find your work. But before you do that, can you confirm that the scarf behind you is supposed to be the Fourth Doctor's scarf?
Absolutely. But here's the problem. I'm allergic to wool. Oh. So trying to find an accurate scarf that isn't made out of wool, that was the best I could do.
Twit Army.
And it was actually a fan got me that.
Twit Army, you've had the gauntlet thrown down, so there you go.
Let's go. I mean, it's so sad though to be like I can't even wear a proper Doctor Who scarf because I get hives.
Oh, I'm sorry, but I know what will make you feel better, and that's by directing our audience to Upgrade Required, directing them to your work. What do you want them to see? What do you think will make them grow their imaginations?
I think. Well, look, I mean, the what I've been doing a lot of this is on Twitter. So if you want to like get in touch on Twitter, if this stuff that comes up, you know. Show us a picture, show us a video. what a flattering shot of myself I put up. You know, that's my forum right now, but we also have upgraderequired.org, which is right now is very, you know, very early stages, but I'm thinking what we're going to need to do is create some kind of I'm about to date myself, a bulletin board system, some kind of a chat system where we could start, letting people start sort of plotting and conspiring together, because I'll tell you, some of my email, as you know, we've been chatting about it, but some of my email correspondence are getting really long and complicated now. So I think that needs to start being put in a forum sort of situation, so we can start properly doing this. Because I keep meeting, like this week alone, I've had like three conversations with incredibly, like one of the guys is fantastic, this toy maker from England who has like this completely autonomous robot wandering around his house, which is honestly better than most of the billion-dollar Toyota type things that I've seen out there. And he's created this, I've been calling it Alexandair, which is basically a barometric way of communicating with Alexa. So if you can't, if you don't have the actual muscle power to speak and activate Alexa,
okay, yeah,
this will use barometric pressure changes. And it means that people behind you talking aren't going to affect your interaction with it. You know, it's just stuff like that. I welcome anybody. This is the funny thing. Everyone I talk to either knows someone who needs help with this stuff or who has technology they want to get out there to help people. And it's not a benign help thing. It's not like we show up and go like, you know, oh, you poor thing. You know, it's, you know, Q is far more involved in the design and the logistics of this stuff. He does his own cooking show for God's sake. You know, it's about empowering people, whether they are, you know, whether they have disabilities or whether they have, you know, super abilities, you know, and it's about turning those disabilities into super abilities. So, you know, if anyone's got anything that you think, you know, is going to sort of resonate with this approach. And I'm also looking for help on how to structure this thing. Cause I really don't know, you know, I make movies. I pretend to be smart. So now I got to actually start doing some smart stuff.
Oh, I think there's plenty of smart in there that you haven't tapped yet. Hewlett,
in the chat room.
This has been a singular pleasure. I haven't spoken to you like this for years, actually, probably close to 3 or 4 years when we did it for Padres Corner. It's been so much fun just to speak with a geek first, who also just happens to be an actor in some of my favorite series. So this has been a wonderful time. Thank you for spending your time with us. Thank you for sacrificing some ski time. To be
no, this is good. The longer I'm talking to you, the less time I'm falling down a hill. So it's entirely selfish.
Well, I will bid you farewell so you can get to that. And oh, and don't forget, we are kind of hoping to collaborate on a few things. And
we are.
You have an open invitation. Once I move to Rome, you're always welcome. If you want to stay 90 seconds away from St. Peter's, I will have a functioning studio by then, and you could actually make it a work trip.
When are you getting there?
September. So September of this year is my official move.
All right. Count on it. I'm there. I'm you kidding? I'm like, that's the kind of offer you don't get often.
We have video proof. So there you go. Again, Hewitt.
Thank you again.
Thank you.
A pleasure. Let's do it again soon.
Indeed.
All right.
And folks, thanks to you for joining us for this episode of Triangulation. Don't forget that we do the show every Friday at 3:00 Pacific time. If you want to watch us live, you can go to live.twit.tv and actually interact with us through our chat room at irc.twit.tv. If you want to see older episodes of Triangulation, because our back catalog is filled with some wonderful, wonderful people, you can always find that at twit.tv/triangulation or try. There you'll find the back episodes, as well as where to subscribe so you can get Triangulation automatically delivered into your device of choice. You can get an audio version, a video version, or a high-definition video version, as well as at TwitTV, as wherever fine podcasts are aggregated. Until next time, I'm Father Robert Ballasaire, the Digital Jesuit, saying see you next time on Triangulation.